It is UX startup.
How do I make it do that?
Is that up there now? Yeah.
Who?
Do you know how to make it not lock?
It should be under
The screen
security. Table. I know, but it's this whole part that makes no sense at all. Security and privacy.
Okay, thank you. I was looking for the universal sign for security.
Our password. There you go.
Let's just check that out. All right. That should be fine.
Yep.
I turned off go to sleep, but... Or I turned off, like, screensaver.
Better, right?
If it doesn't need a password, that's fine. I trust that Kate's not going to...
Kate's totally hacking
my
stuff.
Totally hacking my stuff. Man. All of my secrets are...
That's theirs, yeah. I think that's just for their filling in space.
What? Sweet.
Yeah.
Okay, William, yeah.
So I feel like the area that I'm weakest in when it comes to user experience is the testing part and how to come up with the visual testing and how to do that effectively. So, and I understand from people sitting near me that there's some experts in that particular area.
It's a setup.
Low ball question.
Nice.
Yeah. So let's see.
I actually have a question.
So you can take that one, Cindy? But Ian has a question.
My question is, whose bright idea was it to have daylight savings times like go away right now?
That's right. That is a very bad user experience.
Like, of all the days. At least this is an 11 o'clock panel.
And then we had to actually, we were concerned because the iPhone set off everyone last year.
Yeah.
So we were like, we really hope that thing's been fixed. So I actually set my alarm an hour early, woke up, confirmed that it was actually the correct time, and then set it for another hour and went back to sleep. And this is the workaround you have to do. And like, once uncertainty has been introduced into the product, then...
Once you have lost the user's trust.
It's true. That's true. Once, like, you know, people are trained to this thing. In user tests, I can't count how many times I see people doing things that are just, like, suspicious. It's like turning around three times or, you know, walking backwards through a door, and I'm like, why are you doing that? And they're like, well, I lost some work once, and this seems to work. Like, if I just do this, it'll all be okay.
I remember to just save before I tab out of this field.
That's right.
And then copy and paste everything in the text file.
I always copy and paste my blog posts right before I publish them because for some reason my WordPress installation loses entire posts. So I'm sure they will fix that at some point, and then I will never change the behavior of copy and pasting it ever. Yeah. But yeah, we actually did have a question, so we'll go back slightly on topic, which is that for measurable design, the interesting thing is, you know, there's a lot of quick and dirty stuff you can do ahead of time, you know, showing people mocks, you know, watching, asking them questions, can they complete tasks, but, you know, with most of the applications you're all going to be working on, that is becoming much and much less relevant, because everything is custom now, everything is focused on real user data, and so you can watch someone use your app, they can nod and smile and like it and tell you it is awesome, and as soon as you build out that real thing and show them their own data, they will freak out and head for the hills running. And I've seen this happen more times than I can possibly count, which is why, you know, those of you who've been to Lean Startup Talks, that becomes so important to, like, build something very quickly and as soon as possible, pump it full of a user's data and see what then they actually do. In terms of actually figuring out what you're going to test, there's kind of the question of, like, how will I know when I've succeeded? And the short answer is that, you know, looking for a more number of X is probably too simple an answer. So you think, you know, let's say you add your Facebook and you add a like button. What's your metric for success? Is it how many times you click the like button? No. Because, you know, maybe that's just someone going in and clicking it 47 times and then never logging in again. You have to look at a kind of a balance of, are people doing the thing? Yes, because that means they've noticed it and they understand how to use it. But then what's the long-term effect? So for something like that, presumably you're adding something because you want to increase engagement. So then you look at engagement. Are more people logging in within, you know, a two-day period? Or are people are people coming back who normally would have not come back? So you can do, there are a lot of great tools like Kissmetrics that you can use for simple funnel analysis to kind of figure out things like that. There are plenty of other things as well, but you're looking at sort of both what's the immediate short-term effect and then what's the longer-term effect, which again makes it more important to build quickly because it probably is going to take you 2 weeks to figure out whether or not this thing is having the long-term effect you desire.
And to your point, it's important to keep measuring the long-term effect.
Yeah.
You don't want to locally optimize and then destroy, our conversion went up 5%, but our retention went down 70%.
Right.
It's not a good outcome.
Absolutely. And novelty has a strong effect. You know, at Yammer, we were testing a new email digest format, and, the first 3 days, we're like, wow, open rates are through the roof. And, of course, my job is to be the voice of doom and say, yeah, it's because you've shown them a new thing. They're all going to click on it. They might all be clicking on it and secretly hating it, and then they're all going to get angry. So we keep watching. I'm pretty sure it's already started tailing back off.
So let's go ahead and get started. It is 10:59. We are officially 1 minute early, which is kind of a record, at least for South by Southwest morning panels. So welcome to the UX-driven startup. We are here to talk about balancing, good user experience and in a startup environment where things are moving and shaking and fast and furious. And I'm just curious, I'd love to know, who currently out there actually is involved materially in a startup? Sweet. Okay, good. So that's good.
What's,
number.
What's the other person doing?
You, sir, over there. And now I'm curious, how many of you have UX in your title or the major thing you do every day is considered UX? Great. Now, of those, keep them up. Of those UXers, how many of you guys also write code? Okay. Well, that's not bad. That's good. That's a blend we're starting to see more and more of. So. Great. Without further ado, a couple notes. What we're going to do is do brief introductions, and we've got some questions we're going to do a discussion about. And a little bit of talking, and then we want to open it up for questions from the floor. So to avoid, again, that awkward moment where we're looking at you expectantly and you're looking at each other saying, what the fuck? Please think of some questions, and so we can make this a real dialogue. Coordinates. Take a snap of this. This is Please Tweet This Out. It's UX Startup. I'm Kate Rutter. I'm the moderator. We've got Cindy and Ian and Zach here. Josh Williams, who is originally part of the panel, was unable to join us, so Ian is his mighty replacement. And just to kick it off, so my name is Kate Rutter. I'm a co-founder and a product designer, and currently I'm at a company called Luxor. We are a small but mighty startup in San Francisco, and we work with startup teams, often like you, looking to ensure that the design practices for their product teams are healthy and kind of lean and get good code out in the world with a real user-centered perspective, fast and furious, so that your company and your business can actually grow. Before that, I spent 7 years doing product design with Adaptive Path, which is kind of one of the pioneers for user experience in the world. And I advise companies, many of them small and still under the radar. I'm an advisor to Food Spotting, though, with Alexa Andrzejewski. My coordinates are here. And the reason I was real interested in this panel and bringing it together is because I think that UX-driven and startup can sometimes seem like UX is just a design thing or it's about the pixels, and I think there's a broader story here. And so we wanted to pull together some stories from the trenches and actually talk about what works and what's hard and what's, so that you guys can find your own way through to finding your UX success. And with that, I'll hand it off to Zach.
Hi, I'm Zach Larson. I was the founder and the chief product officer of SideReel. SideReel was founded in 2007. We grew to profitability and were acquired by Rovi in 2011, March of last year.
Yay, acquisitions! Yay, exits!
It was a fun time. I became an accidental UX person. I was a sysadmin and a release engineer and a developer and all those sorts of things for a long time. And then I found out 2 years after starting SideReel that I'd been doing UX all along when I started doing user interviews on the first day. So that was good. My personal passion is making money out of what users actually do. So that means figuring out what they do and trying to get them to do more of them, which is kind of how I define user experience. Right now I'm actively advising and investing in UX-driven companies. So if you've got a company that you think needs money, come talk to me.
Hi, I'm Cindy Alvarez. I come from a background of psychology, user research, product design, product management, and now sort of a mix of all of those. I'm currently heading up user experience at Yammer, where I describe that what I do most of the time is eavesdrop and tell and come up to people and say, here, help, let me help you do that better. Previously, Kissmetrics, Yodlee, bunch of other startups, and I do a lot of ad hoc mentoring. So, you know, if you once you have the money from him and you need some advice, you can talk to me.
And they're hiring.
And I'm hiring.
Oh, who isn't?
It's worth a shot.
And I'm Ian McFarland. Just launched New Context, our brand new lean startup consultancy, and announced yesterday that Eric Reese is joining as a general partner. Before that, I spent 7 years as VP of Technology at Pivotal Labs, doing Agile. I'm a developer from way back. Although both of my parents are design professionals, my dad's an architect, my mom's a fashion designer, so I have a lot of appreciation for design. And I'm kind of here to tell you that you can be a UX-driven startup. There's this big myth about the need for a technical co-founder, and we can talk about that a little bit more.
Sweet. So we're just going to do a little bit of perspective and framing around this question. UX is one of those big words that everybody has their own specific perspective and definition of it. I thought it'd be helpful just for some level setting to put up a model that we've used in Luxor. Won't be probably rocket science to anybody, but it's really helpful just because it's a clear perspective of the difference between UI and design and code and features and all those things. So first of all, as a basic lesson, UX is not the same as UI. In fact, when I was talking to someone, they said, oh, you're on the UX UI driven startup. I said, actually, those things are related, of course, but it's really not the same. So the interface that you have in your product and the experience, the perspectives and impressions that people have of that, certainly related, they are not the same thing. And that comes out in kind of interesting ways. So if you think about just a basic UX model, you've got your users. And users have needs, goals, objectives, right? We talk to people so that we understand these. We can develop empathy for them. And then those needs get transferred into something we call, or starting to call, uses, right? Like, so what can you, your user do with your product that they couldn't do before? And really it's that uses that have that magic moment where you can build a business and you can grow a business as opposed to just delivering some kind of feature set. Once you understand those uses, then you can move into things like features. And the most common starting point that I see for companies and visionaries that are founding companies is to jump right into the features. Like, you have a picture in your head, and the best way to make that explicit is to come up with a whole bunch of features you could build and to start experimenting with code. And that might be a fine place to start, but you can't stay there very long. You need to work your way back up this whole ladder of uses and really understand the users and what they're trying to get out of your product. And then to support those features, you have user stories, themed releases, code development, UI, all of those specialties that go into the craft of actually delivering a great product to the world. The key thing about this model that is super interesting that just helps us center and helps the companies I advise center is everything above that line is about people. And everything below that line is about software. And when we start to mix those up and lack our understanding on it, then it's easy to lose perspective and to jump into just skin it, make it pretty, let's get the code working, and really lose the connection with the perceptions of people in the world. And that's what we're trying to do with these awesome products that we build. So from a UX-driven standpoint, companies and founders and people have visions, right? Like, I don't know that any, and actually I'll advocate pretty strongly that if you only build a company based on user needs and you don't bring your own point of view into why you care, then you're not going to be able to have the chutzpah to be able to carry off a startup through thick and thin. You gotta be in it for the game. And that's where the founder vision comes in. So really, UX-driven is about understanding the vision and the user's perspective and putting those together in a way that there's never going to be any one picture. It's always going to be a balancing point. Right? So how do you stay on that seesaw without getting queasy and sick and freaking each other out? And that's kind of the topic for today. So I'm going to kick it off. That was a little bit of hopefully pontification. I'm not afraid to claim that. But I'd really love to find out from the panelists, like, what else is user-centered design or UX design not the same as? Like, what are the false starts that we can all avoid in our practice?
Pixel pushing. I mean, that's the obvious one. I think you all in the room know that. But there's an awful lot of people who still think, as soon as you talk about UX, that you're really talking about being a designer. And the designer, those are the people who make the icons.
Yeah, listening to everything that the user says and doing exactly that.
Right.
And being surprised when it doesn't work. But you said you wanted that.
No. Right. Yeah. I mean, sort of the flip of that is not what it is, what isn't it, but in my mind, what it is it's, like I said in the beginning, is finding something that people do and finding a way to build a successful business or enterprise out of those things, right? Mm-hmm. So mining those behaviors and those feelings that the users are trying to do and then figuring out how to make money out of them or trying to engage them for some other social good or something like that. That's kind of how I define it.
Sweet. So I want to hear you talk through an example.
Sure. So SideRoll is and was an ad-supported product. Ad-supported products have all sorts of fun things about them. Not really. But about months or year two, we realized we weren't making enough money off of what we knew we were doing. We weren't showing enough ad impressions. So we had a well-tested flow that users could find what they wanted to. It was easy to navigate. Users, they were quite happy at the end, all that good stuff. But we weren't getting enough ad impressions, so we shoved two more page views in the middle. And it annoyed some people, but ultimately, you know, through a lot of testing, we were able to determine that it wasn't that they were still able to flow through the same pattern well enough, and then we were making an extra couple bucks off their session. So that's a good deal every day.
What about you, Cindy?
Let's say, you know, I've been at several startups in the past where the customer-driven aspect has really influenced the roadmap, and I think, you know, probably one of the best things was I've done a lot of enterprise software, and then it ends up being the buyers, who are actually not the users, but that's its own thing. But we had a credit card bill payment product, and we had a customer who wanted it, but they wanted to cut off like half of the feature set. They said, we think this is great. We'll let people pay bills with their credit cards, but we only want to let them enroll in auto pay. We don't want to let them do one-time payments. And I said, that's going to be a really tough sell for people. You know, everyone's been burned by a bad opportunity. No, we really want this. We really want this. Spent time, ripped out half of the product, deployed this thing. It was a disaster. Something like 75% of people who attempted, and these people were being bribed. They were being offered $20 if they could actually successfully enroll. So with a $20 bounty on the table, like over 75% of people who tried to sign up and pay a bill failed. And it was just, it was miserable. So not only do we have a product that was failing, but then the long-term effects of this. Every time we tried to sell that product in the future, they're like, oh, who was your first customer? Oh, what did the numbers look like? Oh, it was just, it was like a DOA. And it was something where, you know, it looked like a fast buck, and it ended up, you know, that money was the most expensive money, I think, that I've ever seen earned.
Was there a lesson you learned out of that?
Don't listen to customers. No.
Like, true.
I mean, as Kate said about the product vision. So we had a vision of we're going to do this thing. We're going to make bill payment easier for customers. We had a customer saying we love it, except not that easier for customers part. And that's where we should have parted ways and said, this is, you know, we respect that you're one of the big four credit card companies, but this is not going to be good for us long term. And that's something we didn't have the wherewithal to do. And I think it was a very expensive mistake.
Well, and you touched on, I mean, the don't listen to customers thing. It's interesting because people tell you you listen to customers and people tell you you can't listen to customers. And squaring that circle is really about realizing that you have to listen to customers to understand, to try to get insight into how they are, the problems that they're having. They're not going to tell you, you know, the Henry Ford quote is like,
right.
If I'd listened to customers, they would have told me they wanted faster horses.
Mm-hmm.
But if a customer tells you they want a faster horse, maybe you should think about what problem they're trying to solve.
Exactly.
Like, maybe they want to get places faster. What if we made a car?
Right. Exactly. And, you know, if their goal was to actually get people locked into this form of bill payment, you know, there's two roads. There's, you know, go only give them one path, or there's make it really attractive for people to start on one path and switch, which obviously since they're willing to pay people, you know, $20 a user, fine. But just do that in a way so that, okay, you can start this, and now you switch over. Or you can start this, and now that option is no longer available. But there was no option to earn that initial trust, and so it was just it was a failure.
I want to talk a little bit about the user experience as far as the users being different from customers, right? So there's a few different models. There's users that are using and also buying your services directly, so their benefits and their investment is paired. And then there's a marketplace where you often have buyers and sellers, and there's a different model for kind of building that out. And then there's people who buy your stuff so that other people can use it, so almost the proxy user. And that's where I see in product design a real difference, right? Like, Zach, you're serving ad customers, yep. right? And they're actually serving their customers too. And then that gets in the way because those objectives aren't aligned. So making a great product for your customers can directly disembowel your customers for your actual user experience. So how do you guys balance that?
I mean, it's funny. So yesterday when the HitMonk guy was talking and he was looking at all the different, I don't know if anybody was at the presentation, but he looks at all these different travel sites and says, all these sites they had, Kayak uses 30% of their space for search results, and this other site uses 19% of their space for search results. And that's all true, but that's because all the rest of the space is used for making money, right? And so, yeah, of course you want to have the most search results or the most useful thing as the dominant piece of any page or any experience, but at the end of the day, the whole thing exists, like SideReel exists, to make money. So if we have to shove 3 ads and a video ad on every page in order to provide the service that we provide, that's okay, right? And so coming to that sort of internal compromise of, hey, now we've just made the page 50% unusable, unless you're looking to buy Ford trucks, which probably none of our visitors are, then, that's okay. That's a fine thing to do. It's just acknowledging that that's what you're doing and driving towards that.
Okay, I totally hate that. I recognize the business expectation of it. I think that there's probably a harder, more different way. So when I was working with clients through Adaptive Path, we always try to look at what's the thing that will make money that actually enhances the feature set that people are using it for. And I know that sounds very, very cliche or very cavalier to say, but I think it's worth really putting your investment and your vision on where is there enough value in this actual usage experience, not where is the aligned or the separate value for using our own customers as fodder for somebody else's business. Which is really the advertising model. So I think that there's probably different and better things that we all need to do, and I invite everyone to look at what's intrinsic to your product that people are going to show up and pay for. And even if they don't pay for it, how can you translate that into something that an allied model, aka AdWords from Google, can actually make better instead of making suck?
Yeah. I love the aspiration of that in we were never able to do that. We tried very hard to do something like that and just couldn't do it.
I also love the word yet, so let's just add that on.
Fair enough.
Cindy, what about you? What's your business model? Because you have a different your enterprise, like Facebook for the enterprise.
So we're enterprise. Yammer is a social network for internal companies. So we're selling primarily to C-level execs and IT folks. Those are the people who are the buyers. They have very specific goals. C-level folks have sort of this vast visionary, I'm going to transform my company, we're going to be collaborative, there are going to be no more silos, it'll be awesome. IT is kind of like, okay, we're going to give people organized places to communicate. Hopefully I won't have to fix as many, do as much support, do as much development. There's a lot of settings and privacy and things that I'm concerned about. And users don't care about any of that. So I think we have kind of a segmented approach of looking at the things that each of these people care about that are not in conflict. So how can we do things that make it easier to administer that also don't screw up the user experience? You can add checkboxes galore to IT, but that ends up inevitably making the end user experience worse because there's a bunch of settings they have to set. There's preferences that they don't like. So we've been kind of taking the notion of what part of the Venn diagram does not overlap? Okay, let's enhance this part so that IT people are happier, and then we're not touching the users. And that's been very, very tricky, and fundamentally all of them are angry at us for not building what they want, but they're all still actually having a pretty good experience.
Ian, anything to jump in on that one? Okay, so you have background through Pivotal, right? Pivotal Labs.
Sure.
And I'm curious because Pivotal is known for having a perspective on code development that makes it possible to deliver great code. When you had to say no to customers that didn't want to engage in that way, like how do you say no to someone who really wants to be part of your business? Because I find that's one of the most seductive things for an early stage company. There's money on the table. How do you say no when it's not the right fit for your vision?
Well, I think that is really important. I think you have to... the way you build a reputation as a company is by excelling at something. And if some customer comes to you with a need that doesn't match what you can provide, it's really incumbent on you to turn that down and stay true to what it is that is your belief and your what you're passionate about in your business. Because if you don't, they're going to have a bad experience. They're going to say, wow, we just paid a lot of money for something, you know, a pivotal and a new context too. If somebody comes to us and wants a body shop, we're a really expensive body shop and it's not going to be a good experience. If they want to come and understand how to make their business more lean and how to develop better software, like when we worked with Zach at Cypreal, it was very much about, you know, if you're just paying for development and you're just going to get a product at the end, it's too expensive. If you're going to, in the process, transform how you do software development, really good investment, because then, you know, you got the product and you also got all this learning. By doing that so consistently, we in lean times, it's a little scary to turn down work. You have to sort of screw up your courage and do it, though, because that's how you build a reputation for being solid. That's how you have 100% positives from your customers, and that's what really makes you grow.
I mean, that's all about sticking to your vision, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's
Pivotal has a clear vision. New Context has a clear vision, right? Siderial's clear vision was to make money, so that's
fair.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think to your point, the biggest it's as important to define the things that you don't do as the things that you do. Like, no, that's not what we do. We're not a body shop. You know, right. We're not a IT can figure it all up to the hilt. Like that's and people respect you for that. You know, customers are actually pretty happy to not hear, oh, we can do everything, because everyone in this room has been burned by a vendor who said we can do everything, because of course they can't. No one can.
And by the way, when you tell somebody you don't do this, but you do this, I can't tell you how many times we've turned down work and then had that person, one, be really happy like you talked about, and two, refer all their friends who need the thing that you actually
totally.
Do.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of how the perspective of UX comes into this, is looking at that vision of what you're trying to do, whether it's, you know, provide a quality service-based organization or make money or whatever, but looking at it through the lens of what do the users actually want to do? What can I help them do? And then is that in line with what I think they should do, right? And then building a business around that. I think that's the role of user experience in a startup, is determining where those things all fit together and in a way that's actually going to be usable.
How do I deliver real value to my customer? How do I solve a real problem that they have?
Right.
How do I make their lives better?
Right. At the end of the day, if I'd shoved those two page views in the middle of the stack and there was no candy at the bottom, no one would have ever gone through it.
Right.
And that's the only way we knew that there was candy at the bottom, and we knew that would work, is because we had people, mostly me, going out and talking to users and doing those interviews and those usability studies. And that was an important part of our early life.
Well, and then you measured it, right? You tested to see that it actually did what you thought it did. And that's critical. I mean, if you're optimizing for money out, it's really important that you don't just, that your local optimization to get another $2 per page doesn't result in a total of 1% page views what you used to have.
Yeah.
Right.
Nice. So one of the questions that I hear a lot is, especially from people kind of in the field, is, well, if you have UX designers, how come your site sucks so hard? Yeah.
So I hear that every day.
Have you ever said that? I'm just curious, because I've totally said that, and I've been sad when people have said it to me. And it's like, well, you know, it's a complicated world, things happen, blah, blah, blah. But I want to know, are there any horror stories about why your site sucks so hard? Or
so in the first... before I knew I was doing user experience, in the first couple years of Siderial, I was doing a lot of user interviews. And the first product that we built was a completely openly editable wiki, which was stupid, about television information, right? And I sat down with, I don't know, maybe 100 different friends and family, potential users, and I said, what do you think about this? And, does it make sense to you? And they all said, sure. I said, great, we should build that. And then 2.5 years later, we rewrote the entire product to get away from the technological underpinnings that had let us down. And that's just because I wasn't listening to what they were telling me at all. And I was doing all the rituals and the hand-waving, and that's great. And I made reports, and I brought them back to the rest of my founders. And I said, we're building something people want. It's amazing. And then no one ever used that. So, yeah, that's a horror story.
Yeah, it's not just talking to customers, it's listening.
Actually
to
listening. That took me an embarrassingly long time to realize that.
Yeah. And listening to a lot of them. There are plenty of things in our user voice that have, 70 votes. You should all do this. And those 70 votes represent, you get 3 votes per person. So, that represents 20-something people who really, really wanted this thing. We have 4 million users. So people will ask for a feature that is completely underused. We get a ton of things. Why? How come your topics should be easier? You should be able to subscribe to topics. You should be able to subscribe to this topic, but not that topic. Like, tons of requests around this. And you know what? Personally, I would like that too, because I am a power user, just like you people in the audience. But if you look widespread across those 4 million people, what percentage of people who have ever added a topic? Less than 1%. Mm-hmm. Like, less than a tenth of a percent. And so, you know, to all those people out there who are trying to rely on that feature, that sucks. That sucks for them. They're like, well, how come you say you're listening and you never build this thing? Because across the universe of our customers, it will not even be a drop in the ocean. And I feel like I experience that every single day with something that people are telling me that they really want, and I feel it, and I know they really want it, but there's no way.
Although that's one, you do have to still be careful around where there's one population that is your content producers, right?
Right.
You have to absolutely tailor to, like, a good user experience for, you know, it depends on
yes.
the type of app, but some apps where there's like 1% of your people are the ones producing yes. all the value that you're then providing.
Absolutely. Some people are more equal than others.
That's right.
But, you know, then we look at things like when you do this, if we do these, we do a lot of things where we'll do a feature and just roll it out internally, and we'll look at things like, are content producing rates going up within our organization? No. Okay. We're all happier. We all like that thing existed, but it's just adding complexity and it's not actually enhancing our behavior. So then we roll it back.
And actually, on that,
listening to customers. Well, the other thing I really strongly recommend is that you listen to criticism first.
Yes. Yeah.
Any criticism that you get from anybody is just the most valuable thing you're ever going to get back. You already know what's awesome about the thing you're doing, right? Like,
yeah.
It's pretty easy to listen to that. It feels great, right? It's really wonderful when you have a wonderful testimonial. But if you go and look at the biggest criticisms people have, those are the things that, if it's pushing somebody to the point of giving you that feedback, it's really
yes.
something that you need to listen to. Doesn't mean you have to do it. It means you need to understand it.
Mm-hmm. Critical feedback is always more useful than positive
right.
feedback.
Yeah.
Sadly.
So actually, let's talk a little bit about, you know, being in a UX or a startup role as being an exercise in masochism, because I think that comes up fairly frequently, and we were just talking in the green room about, well, it's hard and painful, and we don't want to be downers, but, like, there's some serious trade-offs that you take. And, Zach, one of the things that you talk about when we've talked in the past about collaboration is collaboration sounds fun and great, and everybody gets their voice heard, but you know what? Collaboration actually takes a stomach for it that takes a toll kind of on your humanity and relationships. And I'm curious, like, on this, how can you just constantly listen to criticism all the time and not... And still find inspiration in that. And I'm curious how you do that on a day-to-day basis, both you and Cindy.
Well, in my case, the entire company was relentlessly negative people, so we all got used to it.
Awesome.
I'm sorry, relentlessly critical people. That's entirely different.
You want positive critical people.
Sure,
that's
yes.
it. Great.
We weren't that. But I don't know. I think there was a point for me about a year and a half in where I was kind of beaten down. No one liked what we were building inside and out, and that's because I was listening to all the critical feedback, right? And that's when I started to remember to go look at the macro trends. Like, look, our page views are going up. Look, we're making money. Oh, we're doing it's performing the way it should. And even when, you know, someone comes to me and says, you know, our CEO says, we're not making enough money, let's throw 3 more ads on that page. And I go, but it's going to hurt the user experience. It's going to be terrible. And they say, suck it up. I need the money. Right? And then that just made me pull back up, look at the macro level and say, yeah, I do need the money. I want the money. That's important for me. I see what our goals are. Our users want us to be around because we're the only place that's providing a service like this.
Yeah.
So, sure, that makes sense. They'll be worse off if we're not here than if we're here with ads. So, you know, it's kind of seeing the bigger picture, being comfortable with what the goals are, and driving to those goals.
Yeah. If you provide something useful, the worst possible user experience is that you are no longer around
right.
to provide that useful service.
Right.
I think probably about 6 years ago when I was at Yodlee, we had open user forums. This is, I think, before user voice existed. So it was just traditional bulletin board. And people would just come on and be just relentlessly pick us apart. And I remember one day coming across this thread where someone who was a very, very vocal person was like, yeah, these are all the things that suck about it. Like, you know, it's terrible, I can't believe. And then summed it up with, but there's nothing else out there that is better. And I think that's actually, you know, the best possible position you can be in is when you have a whole lot of users who hate you but will freely admit there's nothing better out there. Because then you're probably on that right balance between your vision and being able to provide value and make money and
still providing useful feedback and or still providing a useful service to people.
I mean, so we've had this problem on our site for, let's call it 2 years, where users can end up with duplicate accounts, one from Facebook and one from sort of a native registration. And they complain about it all the time. But we know that it's going to take us like a month and a half of work to fix that. And so we tell the users, we're sorry, we'll help you try to sort it out. And it's been living for 2 years. And we find that when someone comes on to get satisfaction and complains about it, we see what their user account is, and they say, I'm never coming back to this site, I'm abandoning it, I'm burning it to the ground. They still come back tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's fine. So, yeah.
So.
Well, I think you can also be transparent. I think there's a lot that you can do just in engaging with your users and saying, look, we're sorry that we have to do this. We need to do this to keep the lights on.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And honestly, users are pretty receptive to that most of the time. Yeah. They understand. They may not think about the fact that you're running a business, but they, if you tell them, they will understand. And
totally.
I do think that's part of the greater user experience as well, is how you address those things and the way the tone and of the conversation through get satisfaction or what other kind of conduit you have for those discussions. I think that's huge. I think that the trap that you have to avoid is ever falling into contempt of your users or your customers, because contempt is documented scientifically the one emotion that no relationship can actually survive.
Yeah.
So if you feel like there's this snark, like snark is natural, we use it as an output, but I got to say, anytime I've been working with startups who have contempt or that pong about their user base, like those people really need to look at whether or not they're starting a company that is durable enough to be able to make it through thick and thin.
Yep.
And it sounds like even though there's not always the ability to satisfy it, it sounds like there's a real optimism around hearing your customer complaints, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's always nice to hear that feedback. You know, going back to thinking about contempt, it is hard to not generate contempt for people who complain for all of your hard work day after day after day. The way we dealt with it is we just put somebody who was really relentlessly positive in front of us, between us and the users, and she did all the communication, and she's great at it.
Awesome. I'm sure it was a great investment. I don't know how you were able to measure it, but...
Yeah, I don't know how we'd measure it either, but yes, it was a great investment.
I mean, I'm sure you could if you just if you didn't change the site and just changed her, right?
Yeah,
probably.
You
yes.
Could see what you're.
I'm not sure I want to AB that though.
Yeah.
Adding her.
Oh, fair.
Right. Half of you get the nice person, and half of you get Zach. Yeah. I think the other trap, I was just going to say off of that, aside from contempt, the other worst thing you can do is to not respond for fear of stirring them up.
Yeah,
and this is really, really common. I hear, I just don't want to say anything and stir the people up. And, sometimes your response will actually stir everyone up and there'll be a rush of negativity. But, people see silence is actually viewed as contempt, I think. Like, we're all talking and you guys aren't saying anything in response. You're not even telling us you're not going to do it. That's like the ultimate contempt. And I think it's very hard. It can feel like you've been punched in the gut to go out there and like, yes, we've heard you. We can't do this. Here's why. And some people will yell back. But they will ultimately, respect you more for that.
At least there's an answer to their question.
Exactly.
Yeah, even the bad news now means it's settled. And
yeah.
It lets them get out their animus towards it. And
yeah.
then they move on.
Yes. Well, I'm going to, and actually I want to go back to an earlier part of the conversation around the Henry Ford quote, which is also sometimes attributed to the Edison quote of, if I asked my customers, my users, what they wanted, they would have wanted a longer burning candle. Both of those, I'll have you know, are apocryphal. Neither of those has been actually documented, so let's just get that out there. It's the quote that will just send me, through the roof, because I think it somehow has embedded in it, why go out there? Why talk to anybody? I've got those answers. And I just think that's a flawed way to build great stuff, right? You've got to have some kind of conversation or input or empathy. And so one of the things when people make feature requests, or when our customers, we're in a startup as well, say, it'd be great if you could do this. That's not the answer. That's where people are talking about the features. They're using those feature requests as a proxy for something that they want in the world. And it's our responsibility as visionaries or founders or code designers or wireframe junkies, whatever our UX role is, to understand that underlying need behind it. And so just saying, what could you do if you had that thing? Or why would you want that? Right? Like if somebody says, I want a faster running or a faster moving horse, say, great, what would that let you do?
Right.
That's our responsibility, not their responsibility.
I want a longer burning candle. Well, let's look at that. What is inherent in that need? Do they need a little bit more heat in their house? That's one hypothesis. Do they need more light? Right. Do they need light for longer? Maybe they need more light. Maybe they need a safer way to have light. Maybe they don't want to get up to relight their candle.
So I think what's interesting is being able to use those points of inspiration and then test those in really low fidelity ways. I think one of the concerns that I had, Cindy, about when you put something out there and it flopped or failed, was that there's a huge investment in building a lot of feature set, and there's technology investment. So one of the big themes I've seen emerge in the practice is how can you find out smarter, cheaper, faster, what people really will use, and to Zach's point, what people will buy and pay for. I'd rather have a very small footprint with someone paying a dollar for something rather than have something that could go out and be worth $100. Because if somebody's not going to throw down their money, then I can't validate that that's real. And I actually have a story about that. We're building a product. It's a kind of hybrid physical digital product. It's a box for entrepreneurs to learn some of the lessons around these concepts up on the screen. And so my co-founders and I, we made these 10 physical boxes. Like, we went to Flax, which is an art supply store, and we bought these materials. It was essentially an activity that was self-running. And we put together 20 of these. It took us days. Like, it was sad. We were there cutting things by hand, assembling this kit of parts so that someone could go through this activity. And we took them to Tokyo with us because we're looking at an international kind of global market of entrepreneurs. And we sat down. We did customer interviews with a whole bunch of people. And people were they thought it was interesting and novel and delightful. And they were all like, oh, yeah, I really like this, you know. But when we actually asked them, only one person out of 20 bought it, right? And she was buying it because it was interesting enough to take back to her work to see if her company would be interested in it. And, you know, that wasn't good enough. So even though we could have listened to the, wow, people really liked it, they responded, we're onto something big, that's what we wanted to hear, and honestly, we could have taken that, but it was bullshit because nobody really bought it. And that was the thing we needed to test the most. So we had to come back and do a redesign, and when we reframed that product to be something for accelerators who really do want to make an investment in these kinds of activities, within the first month of announcing that product, like, we had $20,000 worth of sales. So that was a better signal, turns out, than having someone not pay for it.
You're looking at us like you have a question.
I'm looking at you because you're pretty. Let's see.
We're all just nodding enthusiastically. Yeah. Yes.
But I'd love to tell you, it's about halfway through our time together, and I want to open it up for questions. Questions that you guys have and pushback. I mean, you know, we're up here talking, but we're like you. We're founders that are trying to make it go.
If you have questions, please use the mic because we're going to be podcasting. I think there's a mobile mic that we can bring.
Can we get a mobile mic?
I'm going to
restate
the
question.
Video thing?
Yeah. So you're really asking about how UX plays into video.
Yeah.
It does. Huh?
Try harder.
Really,
try harder.
I don't really know. I don't know how to define it succinctly. So we have a bunch of video that we film, original content mostly, and we. I'll tell you a story about how we determined our use of video on our site. Maybe this will answer your question, maybe it won't. But so we knew in 2010 that there was a lot of video advertising available out there in the world, and pre-roll video advertising, and we needed some way to capture that inventory. So we started filming videos in one corner of our office with a flip video camera, and it was people like me and a couple other people just talking about TV shows. And, you know, we would go and we put those on the site, and yep, people do watch those. Yes, they only watch those for 15 seconds, so that's not going to work. So then you find out, oh, you need to have a little pre-roll teaser ahead of that, right, before you show the ad. That just, when you come to the page, the video is not playing, but it says, the big play button, news and reviews about Gossip Girl. You're all giant Gossip Girl fans, I can tell. You're all 13-year-old girls. You know, kind of the analysis of, we know we need to get to this business goal, right? We're trying to display video ads. We know that in order for that to work, users have to engage for a certain amount of time. What's the right way to get them to engage? And we tried 3 or 4 different models until we found one that would cause a user to watch that 30-second video ad and then a minute or so of actual video content. So it's not that much different from anything else. I mean, that video that I'm talking about isn't like a deeply interactive video. So I don't know if that's really answering your question well or not, but fair enough.
I really love the idea of video as just a creative material. It's kind of like saying, you know, what's the purpose of better interactions? But I think that the way that is delivering information now is really screwing with our sense of expectation around search and finding content and actually how you start to digest that. So any site or any company that's not looking at video as a means to communicate a really engaging message, I think you need to do that.
We actually, so on our sign-up page, we ran an A-B test where we have the sign-up form, and on the one side there's the typical text and icons explaining why you should sign up and all that, the user value. And that converted pretty well, 7.5%. And we turned all that into a video, read by a very nice-looking gentleman in our office, and our conversion went up to 8.5%.
Same.
Okay. We don't know why, but we know the numbers are good. Great.
Well, but measuring it tells you whether it's working.
No.
And then you can A/B test the video too. You can see.
What, yeah. Right.
And then I think especially segmenting which video you showed based on
yep.
population is
yep.
super interesting.
Yeah. But even being able to tell that a video was driving more engagement than just text was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Right. You can even look at things like how is the production quality affect what
yep.
you know what the conversion rate looks
totally.
Like.
Great. Thanks.
I have a question about the features when you do make it to that part of your little chart there. So should you develop the list of features first and then ask people if that is what they're looking for, or should you let them kind of tell you what they're looking for in terms of features based on their needs?
If you ask people if they want something, they will always say yes.
Yeah,
so don't do that.
I think you should ask people what they want in order to understand, again, what needs they have. But it's not like... Don't take out of that a feature list. Take out of that some discovery. Like again with the candle example, like what? Okay, you said
the camera.
You know, and then do some follow up questions around like so. Did you? You said you wanted a longer burning candle. Is it because you again need more heat in your house? Is that using it as a cooking source? Try to like make some assumptions about what they're asking for, and then test those assumptions by asking them back before you even start ideating about what features you want to build.
I mean, and asking about the features, that's something you can do at a different stage in the research, right? It's just not the first thing that you do, I think. Right.
Yeah, features should be subordinate to what the user experience you're trying yeah. to do, provide is. Yeah. Like, what is the service? Like,
cool.
Yeah. They're not going to tell you, I want flyovers. They're
right.
going to tell you, like, I want to balance my checkbook.
Right. Realistically, I don't think I've ever gone into a customer interview without having some features in mind. Like, that's just, there's a lot of people. They like thinking about features. We usually have them. But I try to put those as far out of my mind. So I might say something like, oh, tell me about how you're using candles today.
Right.
And just let them talk for as mm-hmm. long as they possibly will before ever starting to get into, you know, well, if you had a longer wick, would you, I mean,
right.
that's like, that should be the very end of your interview. And if you never get to it, that's fine.
And use undirected questions to sort of do that discovery, and then maybe use directed questions when you're trying to validate that you heard them correctly.
Hey, Ian, there's a mic next to your mic that's causing...
Is that?
I think that's our problem.
Sorry.
Better.
It's important to get feedback, but that's not the kind.
Yeah. Well played,
nice
my friend.
Job.
Great. So it looks like you've got
Thank
some good
you.
Questions. I hope that was sufficient. If not, grab us afterwards. And actually, I'd like to ask that when you do your question, if it's directed to any one of us, go ahead and just say who that's directed to. We'll try and attack that. And if not, jump in.
Sure. So this one is not directed to any one of you. So, and this is getting a little bit at sort of features first or needs first, but so we're in a situation where client has well-funded project with a...
Awesome.
That's solving a problem that we're not sure people have.
Too bad.
And I guess I'm just sort of curious if you've got war stories or tips on how do you identify that and you know sort of troubleshoot. Are we really trying to solve something that's going to be useful or not? And even just getting at the nugget of something related that you can still make money on, but even just trying to course correct into a problem that people really do have that we actually can solve.
I think data helps a lot. Like, if you can, let's user test this. Like, be very friendly. If you, I mean, you may be wrong also that their problem doesn't, that isn't the right solution.
Yeah.
So I think the best way to solve those kinds of problems is to go, you know, figure out a reasonable test that you can, you know, cheaply put in front of somebody
yeah.
and see if it actually is solving a problem. Maybe in that they get some new insight into something that's adjacent, that's still true to their vision, that, you know, a pivot.
And remember to stay open to the fact that maybe there's nothing there.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, maybe you've got this funded project for something that no one actually wants.
Right.
And knowing that early so that you don't fall into the canyon of despair. Like, yeah. There's nothing, the worst outcome of all is building something that is awesome and beautiful in the world and perfect and rocks that nobody wants.
Yes.
Like, that is the worst feeling. And if you spend a year of your life doing that, that's a bad year.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's totally where we're at right now.
Lean startup.
But I think even before you get to a point of A/B testing, and you know this is hard because it's hard for people to actually take this feedback, but if you've talked to people, and I always say, like, people should be showing emotion. If they have a problem, you are going to hear their voice. You're going to hear it in their voice. You're going to see it in their body language if you're talking to them. But you're describing is, tell me about how you do X. And, you know, in the course of this, they run across the problem. And you kind of say, well, tell me more about that problem. They're like, oh, yeah, it's kind of a pain. That is not something people are going to throw down money for. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're going to, like, with things that we've solved problems, I hear people, like, you know, slamming the desk in the background. I hear people start swearing about things. People start, you know, in some cases, they're kind of embarrassed. I mean, with Kissmetrics, people be like, God, I know I should be measuring things for my company, but I'm just not. And, like, that sort of, like, that obvious note in people's voices was something that was a good indicator. But I've both done customer interviews and overheard them where the response is like, yeah, that does happen to us. It's not a problem.
Yeah. It's helpful. Thanks.
Thank you.
So this is for everybody. My name's Charlie Wood. I'm the founder of a company here in town called Spanning, and we do online backup for Google Apps. Anyway, we as a company recently, fairly recently, in the last 6 months or so, have sort of had our eyes open to the importance of UX. And where we were blind, now we see, right? This is in no small part. Yeah, absolutely. And we're converted now. It's in no small part due to our new UX guy, BJ Heinle, who some of you know. But one of the things that he has gotten us doing is looking outside of software, right? Outside of the interfaces and even the experiences and emails to the real world, right? To see examples of good UX and bad UX and try and get an intuitive sense for what that is. And so my question to you guys is, as you walk through the world, I imagine that you see the world through that lens. And do you have examples outside of software of really good UX and examples of really bad UX?
United Airlines. Guess which category?
Doors where it's not clear if you're pushing or pulling. And, like, that's so small, but you feel like an idiot when you guess wrong and other people see you. It's just, like, it's one of those little things that makes your day a little bit worse.
I think the best UX experiences, whether they're physical or digital, always come when there's a voice of a human behind it, and it felt like it was made by humans for humans. So there was a sign in a restaurant that I like, and it's kind of just a dive. But inside, it has this beautiful little sign that says, the hot water is really, really hot, right? And so clearly, somebody burned themselves on that, and they put up this little sign. I don't know why they didn't just fix the hot water. Maybe the sign's cheaper. But, you know, it was just the fact that that was a human moment. It's like in Dropbox, when you get ready to boot someone out of a shared folder, and instead of saying remove this person, it says kick them out, right? And it's just this little touch. Like, a computer's not going to come up with that, but a person will. So the ones that I hate the most are when people try and be so neutral and so non-emotional that it feels like they don't just, like, they're the phone company that don't care. Right. My favorite sentence in the world is on the buses in San Francisco, which says, it's near the driver, and it says, information gladly given, but safety requires avoiding unnecessary conversation. Which, the best thing about this is it's not a sentence because there's no subject in it at all. But, like, how more inhuman, like, don't talk to the driver, right? Like, please don't talk to me. I'm driving the bus. Your safety is at stake. Like, let's try that. So
I'm not being polite, okay?
Right.
All right, cool.
What about any others?
Oh, I just have to say this for the, like, so for those of you who live in the Bay Area, if you go on BART, that's a public transit, there's one map in every station. Yeah. And I know someone was like, this is good, right? We have a map in every station. No problem. So if you get off the train over here, you have to walk all the way to the other end to see that sign. And I cannot count the number of times that I have missed a train, because even though I live there, I don't take it often enough to have things memorized, where I've missed a train because I wasn't sure that that was the right train, and I have not gotten to that sign yet. And it's just a clear case of, like, no one actually, when they put that sign up or thought about it, thought, gosh, maybe we should have these everywhere. Maybe we should have more helpful, you know, signs. It's things like that kill me.
The Singapore MRT has exactly the opposite. Basically, every train, it shows the whole map about on each side of the platform. and shows where you are and shows the next stations all the way to the end of the line. So you're very clear about where you're going.
Yeah.
Wayfinding stuff is that's a whole fascinating study. If you just look at like most of it's horrible.
Yeah.
Right,
but there are,
okay, so there's an opportunity for founders there.
We always want to know where we're going. Yeah. That's so universally applicable. Just want to know what's happening next.
Thanks, go for it.
So this question's for everyone. I came from a company that was very similar to Get Satisfaction, faced a lot of the same challenges. And I'm wondering, how do you actually build the capacity for user-centered design and empathy within an organization where the culture might not be really set up for it right away?
Hire people that are good at it, or try to train people inside that are good at it, and give them enough power to be able to make decisions.
Hmm. Yeah, pretty much.
I think that's the right answer.
Cool. Thank you.
And honestly, I do believe that if you're a founder and you don't have that commitment that this is important, it's not going to stick.
Yeah.
So I work with engineering cultures all the time, and just because they're engineering or code cultures doesn't mean that the value of empathy and customer voice isn't valued highly, even though there might not be the competency or the interest on the executive or the leadership team. But I think if at any point you think that doesn't matter, then I don't think you can be a UX-driven company, no matter how much you think it's going to be a distinguishing factor. It's just not part of your DNA.
Yeah, I mean, that has to be represented on the executive team.
Yeah.
I think that's just true.
And honestly, if you're a practitioner and you're looking to start a company and you don't feel like someone can actually look you in the eye, the person who at the end of the day has to make the bad decisions and say, no, we really believe in this, and we want you to be wrong as much as you're going to be right about this, then I think find a better fit. Honestly, it's not worth it. It's your life. Don't waste it.
Hi, this question's for Zach primarily, but I'd be interested in what the rest of you have to say as well. Given that this is about UX-driven companies, UX-driven startups, you made the comment about the multiple logins with Facebook.
Yep.
And it seems to be in direct competition with what we're talking about here, because that really feels like you're putting your own pain, a back-end business process, a technology ahead of the actual user experience.
So how
do you reconcile that?
That's a good question. Actually, that's probably a better question for Kate than it is for me. But at the end of the day, it's because user experience is not the sole driver of our business. It has to be baked off against everything else, just like everything else. But you've got a better response than that.
Or maybe not. I think on those the key part is that it's constantly going to be a balancing process, right? So there's times when you have to triage the end user feature behavior. I'm not going to say the UX overall, but because that's too broad. But the behavior or the inclusion of a feature in trade-offs so that your vision can stay real or your company can stay in business. And what's really missing from the slide up here, and it's becoming more apparent, is there's the vision and there's the user perspective, but there's not actually the engine of growth, which is the financial revenue model. And I think that is constantly part of that triangle of balances. So the key thing is don't live in one place too long.
I think it's really important to sort of make informed choices about those trade-offs. I mean, it's not like you didn't know this was a big pain point. You weren't saying, this is the user experience we want, but you looked at that user experience and said, yeah, that's really crappy, but it's going to take a month and a half where we could be providing other more useful features that all of our customers need. This is causing pain for a small percentage of our user base.
Dude, don't get me wrong. It makes me cry a little inside that that's a problem that still hasn't been around for as long as it has, but at the end of the day, a month and a half of engineering work is a month and a half of engineering work.
Yeah,
I think a lot of it's about making informed choices and understanding the user impact so that you can say, actually, that's at some point, maybe that is more important than a month and a half of feature development.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Although, amusingly, as a corollary to that, we actually just started fixing that problem because now it's a bad enough problem that it is worth a month and a half.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, see?
Sweet.
See?
Hi. In the beginning, Kate, you had asked us how many of the UX folks also coded. And Zach, you had mentioned something about designers being, or UI folks being the ones that make the icons. So I wanted
I said that, and I said it's not
true. Oh, sorry.
We do look awful on like
that. It's the men with beards panel.
I wanted to find out what's the value of someone who's in UX who codes as opposed to someone who designs, because I think there was also the note about the question of you guys, we have UX, but then the interface still looks crappy. So, where is the balance there? Is it more helpful for someone who's in UX who codes as opposed to someone who's also who can design?
I think
looking at
one framing idea about this is somebody who knows the material. It's really valuable to understand the material you're working in.
Yeah.
You wouldn't go, you want to build a sculpture. You wouldn't go to a marble consultant who had never worked with marble, because you would end up with like this design idea of this really thin piece of marble going 400 feet across, just about this thick. You know, it's really useful as a designer to understand the material you're working in.
So why did you ask that question about?
I was curious because I do think that increasingly as we're starting to, UX-driven companies are starting to experiment with smaller things, lower fidelity things, rather than like big pre-planned launch of code.
Right.
That being able to have a hands-on relationship to the material, the creative material, as Ian was referencing, as a thinker, so you're thinking through the materials, testing them really early, kind of is putting a different set of skills together. Right. So in a waterfall method, being able to go through specification and functional behavior and then visual design, that seemed to make more sense. But now you're playing and experimenting.
So are you talking more about being able to produce that rapid prototyping and things like that as opposed to, like you said, I guess...
Yeah. I wasn't talking about like one person doing it all and having kind of domain expertise all the way from customer empathy down to front end, like launchable, scalable code. I think that's probably a stretch, and you know, whatever, unicorns and ninjas and gurus, be damned. But I do think that not having those connective layers, not being able to experiment and test early, is a severe limitation for your ability to learn.
Yeah, I think it's an absolutely critical skill set to have on really any team, but especially a team where you're trying to do rapid iteration and trying to really find your product market fit. The ability to have somebody on the team who can who has good UX insights and then can reduce them to, you know, their good CSS and good, you know, at least edit JavaScript to make it do, like, tweak it to do what it needs to do.
Yeah,
and,
right. Just sort of dirty code it. Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
I mean, I think to be broader, the concept of a UX designer in a vacuum as a silo is going away.
Yes.
You may not be UX and coding, but, I mean, I think I wouldn't hire someone who was, you know, I do design. It's like you can do design and... you know, have some background in research. You could have design and have some background in product management. You could have design and also have a technical sense. But for this to permeate the culture, you need to be able to talk to other people. Like, if everyone has their tentacles into some other department, you're going to be vastly more successful than if it's kind of like, okay, well, if we bring this over to Cindy, you know, then she can make it better. Like,
did you design this now?
Exactly. That's completely, you know, that's completely backwards. Like, the driven part means, like, you need to be able to, if someone throws the keys to you, start driving.
And big shout out for research there. Like, if you also have some research background, this is much... We aren't talking about it enough, but I think that really is going to be before.
Yeah.
So I want to jump here with an anecdote from Luxor. We have a design program. We've worked with over 30 startup companies, and then we have one-day workshops for companies, founders come and kind of experiment with, especially understanding the user's needs and uses. And one of the activities is about creating, like, sketching out uses for your product vision and your idea. And we have business people, subject matter experts, coders, and designers always in the room together. And at the end of that activity, we've asked every time, did it matter who played which role? Like, did it matter that you were a developer in that conversation? And the answer has always been no, because at a certain point of framing and thinking the right things to build, the specialty skills of how you're going to play that out don't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important to have a bunch of specialty skills, but it's important to also not have silos.
Right. And it doesn't need to be concentrated in any one person. The team is just a group of disciplines, wherever that happens to fall. That's great.
So last question, Shri.
I think you almost answered my question before I asked it.
Good. Thank you.
Well, maybe to clarify what the question was, I was just wondering if you do have designers or UX designers that are willing, and you have some more traditional coders that are just doing their thing in isolation, how do you, besides getting the coders and designers in one room, how do you... solicit or facilitate decoders just kind of stepping up and being like, let's collaborate and let's really work together, as opposed to like the designer being like, I want to do this, and the coder being like, sure.
My favorite thing is to have a designer and developer pair together.
Yep.
Have them both sit down,
and let's build this thing together. There's a lot of knowledge transfer that happens. The developer becomes more sensitive to the design and what's motivating the design, and doesn't then complain, why are we moving this thing 2 pixels to the left again? And then the designer gets a better insight into sort of what the underlying sort of architecture is and what the implications are for their design.
Mm-hmm. And for larger projects, I assume that would also be an information architect too, so they can really, you know, get...
People should be collaborating as much as possible. Yeah. I think the more collaboration you have, the faster your feedback is, the lower latency you have to be able to make changes, and the more responsive your whole company is to the environment that it's operating in.
I think the first step to that is to always say why. And that's a requirement on my team. You can advocate for anything you want, but you better have a reason.
Why is that?
Because it helps educate everyone. I mean, I think there's a stereotype, and I mean, like, we're talking to a lot of designers here, so you guys know that you know, design kind of goes off in the corner and does their thing. There's also the same stereotype about engineers, like they just go off and they do their own thing, and they know better, so don't ask them. And I think that's so harmful.
It is.
Because, you know, there's no way those two can ever come to, you know, can ever find any common ground if they're not suggesting what that common ground might be.
Especially if they're both always right.
I know. So, like, you know, it's like between the two of us, one of us is always going to be right. If you start with that as
both.
Like a common understanding, sometimes both. But, like, at least one of us is going to be right-er. But as soon as you start saying, here's what I think and here's why, then the conversation changes. It can't just be like, I don't want to do that. It might be, okay, well, I think your reasoning is flawed, and let's talk about why your reasoning is flawed, or, you know, here's why I think this is a bad idea. But as soon as you get...
Or this approach is really hard, and it's going to be...
Yeah, exactly. And I found that, you know, when designers start saying that, engineers, in my experience, have been really good about responding back. Well, the reason I'm pushing back is because this will take 6 weeks to build. And then everyone goes, oh, well, we don't want you spending 6 weeks on that. And suddenly everyone's like, oh, we're actually in alignment. We're not trying to take blows at each other. We want to build a nice product together and make money.
And it's not one person's decision yes. or the other. It's something that's a whole different direction that wouldn't have been possible without collaboration.
And bringing it all back around, I mean, the UX-driven part of startups is having someone who cares about that stuff in the beginning as part of that team, right? I mean, you hear a lot of talk about you have to have a technical co-founder and a business co-founder and you're done, right? And that can be fine because kind of either one of those people can play a designer, but you should have somebody representing that sort of stuff in the beginning.
Okay, kids, we're wrapping it up. We're right at noon, so we can follow up on the question. I do want to leave with one thing, which is when in your question there was this one word that really was a hot spot for me, which is just. Anytime someone says, I just want to build code, I just want to talk to customers. At this stage of a startup, you can't afford just. We'll just launch that thing. It's always a diminishing word, and you can use it as a way in to say, like, why? There's going to be a barrier there. Because you know what? We are so not just making products. We are making freaking awesome products. And part of the UX-driven part, can you hear the angels singing? Because this is the big wrap-up, kids. But is to go out and be awesome and not just do something, but do the right awesome thing and test it and put it in front of customers and have your products be real conversations that people will pay for. That's for you. Okay? And thank you for spending your time with us. We've loved this.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Make sure to rate the panel and rate it awesome or else.
Yes.
Oh, yes.